ladder. When he reached the footpad, Conrad was waiting with his camera. "Okay, turn around and give me a big smile. Attaboy, you look great. Welcome aboard." For the rest of his life, people would ask Bean what he was thinking at this moment, and he would tell them that his thoughts were on one thing, his checklist. On his left cuff, he wore a checklist that looked like a small spiral notebook. Conrad had one, too. On those pages, almost every minute of their time on the moon was accounted for. Before the flight, it had been Bean, with his love for detail, who had delved into the task of helping to write that checklist. But before he set about his assigned tasks, there was something he wanted to do. Reaching into a storage pocket on his thigh, he pulled out his silver astronaut pin, the one he had worn on his lapel during his 6 years as a rookie. When he returned to Earth, he would receive the gold pin of a space veteran. Now, with a few halting steps, Bean stood at the edge of the surveyor crater. He flung the pin into it. According to the checklist, Bean had 5 minutes to gain his balance and learn to walk. He was amazed at his new buoyancy. "You can jump up in the air."
"Hustle, boy, hustle. We've got a lot of work to do." Conrad's voice.
Conrad had one rule: stay on the timeline. It was true that in their 2 moonwalks, the two men would spend more than 7 hours outside, about 3 times the amount Armstrong and Aldrin had, but all of that time was packed with objectives, and Conrad did not want to fall behind. Right now, he was setting up an umbrella-shaped S-band antenna to improve communications with Earth. He called to Bean, "How about doing some useful work, like getting that TV camera going?"
"Okay," Bean answered brightly. "Good idea. Let's get that TV out and show everybody."
That didn't go as planned. While Bean was carrying the camera on its tripod away from the LM, he accidentally pointed it too close to the sun for a few long seconds. By the time Bean realized the mistake, it was too late. The moonscape on televisions in Houston and across the world had changed into a jumble of black-and-white shapes. Nothing Bean tried, even rapping on the camera with his geology hammer, seemed to work. History's second moonwalk had become a radio show. But with Pete Conrad on the moon, who needed television? When he wasn't talking to Bean, he was talking to himself, or he was humming or laughing. In the midst of some task, he would suddenly cackle, and no one knew why, except the backup crew, Dave Scott and Jim Irwin, who had arranged for a few additions to the cuff checklist. They had adorned the pages with cartoons of Conrad and Bean as Snoopy astronauts, just like the comic strip Beagle's spacefaring persona. But what really made Conrad laugh were the Playboy pinups, reduced to about 3 inches square, annotated, of course, with proper geologic terminology. Don't forget, describe the protuberances. The funny thing was, there were a couple of mounds poking up from the undulating plain. The geologists had asked him to keep an eye out for unusual features, and here they were. They were a few hundred feet from the LM. Conrad made a mental note to get over and take a look at them, perhaps after the ALSEP work. 7:14 a.m. "We're making our move, Houston." As Conrad announced their departure, Bean lifted what looked like a strange, square set of barbells and began walking west. The barbells were actually 2 pallets loaded with the ALSEP's scientific instruments. There was a seismometer to measure moonquakes, a magnetometer to look for a lunar magnetic field, another sensor to sniff out the moon's incredibly tenuous atmosphere, and others to search for ions in the moon's vicinity and analyze high-energy subatomic particles emanating from the sun. There was also a central transmitting station to relay the ALSEP's data to Earth. Together, these experiments comprised the first full-fledged scientific station to be set up on another world. Bean planned to carry the ALSEP several hundred feet from the LM, far enough so that the instruments would not be affected in any way by the dust kicked up when he and Conrad blasted off tomorrow. As he walked, Bean could feel his heart pounding with the effort to grip the bar with his stiff, pressurized gloves and hold the packages out in front of him. "I'm going to set it down and rest," he said. Meanwhile, Conrad ran out ahead of him, scouting a good area to lay out the experiments. In their 2.5 hours on the Sea of Tranquility, Neil Armstrong and Buzz Aldrin had never ventured more than a couple of hundred feet from their lander. Now, 1 hour and 48 minutes into this first moonwalk, Conrad and Bean were extending the reach of lunar exploration more than twice over. Bean walked until he came to a level place about 500 feet from the LM. Bean couldn't count the number of times he and Conrad had practiced setting up the ALSEP on a simulated lunar surface behind the flight crew training building. To an unaccustomed eye, the experiments looked like strange, delicate creations. In truth, each was an engineering marvel, built to withstand lunar heat and cold, and to perform on a minimum of electrical power, and be small and lightweight to boot. Bean knew each of them well. There was the seismometer, which looked like a silver paint can atop a round silver drop cloth, and the magnetometer, with its three gold-foil-tipped arms reaching into the vacuum. The small ion detection experiment, with its ridiculously short legs joined by a spiderweb of wires, and the squat little solar wind spectrometer with its odd facets and bubbles, each of them would make incredibly sensitive measurements to probe the moon and the void around it. Laying out the ALSEP wasn't the kind of work people expected an astronaut to be doing on the moon. It was more like arranging garden furniture than like exploration. Undo bolts, set each experiment on the ground, tamp the dirt and make the instrument level, make sure each one is pointed in the proper direction with respect to the sun, using a shadow indicator, and that each is the proper distance from the others, and keep them from getting dirty. This was the job, and as he worked, Bean felt pride of accomplishment. There was Conrad, a few yards away, working on the central station. His white suit glowed in the sunlight, except from the knees down, where it looked as if it had been dragged through a coal bin. Bean knew that Conrad was not immune to awe. You had only to be in the same spacecraft with him orbiting the moon. He talked a blue streak about the craters and mountains and lava formations and how amazing it all was. The important thing was, it never slowed him down. He was always spring-loaded, ready for the next event. Around him, the ocean of storms stretched in all directions, an undulating plain that rose and fell with craters of every size. Surprisingly, if Bean didn't think about it, the moon didn't really seem like an otherworldly place. But if he looked high into the black sky, he saw the Earth. And the sight of it was enough to bring home the electrifying realization of where he was. And he told himself, "You don't have time now. You can think about this after the flight." But just now, things were going well, and when he began to deploy the magnetometer, Bean allowed himself a moment of fun. Removing a set of styrofoam packing blocks, he took one of them and gave it a sidearm fling, and it sailed into the distance for an impossibly long time, tumbling in slow motion against the black sky before landing. He took a second block and called out to Conrad, who was busy working. "Pete? Pete? What? Watch this." Bean made an underhand toss. The white shape ascended on a long, lazy arc and hit the dust. Boing! "Stop playing," Conrad laughed, "and get to work. Come on, maybe they'll extend us until 4.5 hours. I feel like I could stay out here all day." It was true. They could have handled a moonwalk twice as long as the 3.5 hours allotted, and that's what Conrad would say in the debriefing when he was back on Earth. It took Conrad and Bean over an hour to set up the ALSEP, but when they were done it resembled an odd five-pointed star with the central station in the middle and the experiments radiating from it on bright orange ribbons of cable. They looked just like the ones in training, except for one problem. It was almost impossible to walk past an experiment without spraying dirt on it. In no time the clean white surfaces were sprinkled with black powder. There wasn't any point in trying to wipe it off. That would only have ground it in. "I remember how they took care of this white paint," Bean said. "You had to have gloves to touch it, remember?" Conrad laughed. "Yeah, they got kind of a problem here." Well, Bean decided, there wasn't any point in worrying. Dirty or not, the experiments would just have to work. Finally, the ALSEP was laid out and ready, and Conrad activated the central station. At that moment, in a back room down the hall from Mission Control, scientists gathered excitedly around a set of chart recorders. On the tracing for the seismometer, they saw little squiggles and bumps, not from moonquakes, but from Conrad's and Bean's footfalls as they headed away from the ALSEP to gather samples. In lunar orbit, aboard Yankee Clipper. Every 2 hours, a tiny, unblinking star appeared in the eastern sky above Intrepid, ascended to the zenith, then vanished in the west. It was bright enough for Pete Conrad to see with the naked eye from the LM cabin. The star was Yankee Clipper, carrying Dick Gordon on a 38-hour solo voyage around the moon. Before the mission, Gordon had wondered whether he would think of the Earth and feel his awesome separation from humanity. Instead, he savored his aloneness, and mostly he was too busy to think about anything besides the flight plan. But when there was a lull, his thoughts turned to his friends on the ocean of storms. Gordon envied Conrad and Bean more than he could say. Mike Collins had said he was perfectly happy going 99.9% of the way, but that wasn't how Gordon felt. Walking on the moon, not orbiting it, was the name of the game. It was as simple as that, and it had been his goal from the day he joined the astronaut corps. Gordon rationalized his position, telling himself that down the line, on one of the later missions, he would get his chance. But when he watched Conrad and Bean climb into that lunar module and pull away, he wished he were going with them. His crewmates knew it. Conrad had said he wished the LM held three people so they could all land together. When Conrad steered the lander to a touchdown, Gordon was listening, and as the dust settled on the ocean of storms, he radioed congratulations and told his friends, "Have a ball." On the next orbit, when he flew over the landing site, he was ready to try to spot Intrepid on the surface. Unlike Mike Collins, Gordon knew exactly where to look, and he knew the navigation was so good that all he had to do was tell the computer to point the sextant right at the snowman. At the proper moment, the optics whirred into position, and there, just off the rim of the surveyor crater, he saw a point of light with a needle-like shadow, and he knew he had found them. "I have Intrepid," he announced to Ed Gibson, and as he got closer, he could almost convince himself he could see details. Four landing legs sticking out from the descent stage, though he knew the sextant wasn't powerful enough for that. He was in the middle of reporting Intrepid's position when he spotted another point of light nearby. "I see Surveyor! I see Surveyor!" Gordon was jumping up and down, he would say later, if it's possible to do that in zero-G. If he could not make the first pinpoint lunar landing, then he had been the one to discover that it had been a success. He told Gibson, "That's almost as good as being there." When Conrad and Bean took their moonwalk, Gordon was there vicariously. Thanks to Mission Control's relay, he could listen to his friends as they bounced along. At one point, as the two moonwalkers wrestled with a bulky piece of gear, Gordon couldn't help but laugh at what he was hearing. Later, he would tell his crewmates, "You were raising hell about some stupid device, and I was laughing my ass off." In the moonwalk's last hour, Gordon prepared for his most important task of the day, a burn of Yankee Clipper's SPS engine to adjust his orbit. If you could stand on a fixed platform in space, you would see that the moon slowly turns as it orbits, at exactly the rate needed to keep the near side pointed at Earth. You would also notice that the orbit of Yankee Clipper stayed in a fixed orientation, with the result that each new circuit of the moon brought Dick Gordon slightly west of his previous position. If he did nothing, then over the 31.5 hours that Conrad and Bean were on the moon, Yankee Clipper's orbit would shift far enough from the landing site to ruin the prospects for tomorrow's rendezvous. This 14-second firing would nudge Yankee Clipper into the proper orbit. By now, Gordon was very tired. Of course, test pilots are used to performing while fatigued, but he did not want to make a mistake with the whole world watching. But now it was just him inside Yankee Clipper, surrounded by a forest of switches and dials, doing a task that had been performed by three men on every previous lunar mission. As he prepared for the burn, he could hear Conrad and Bean going on excitedly about mounds and rocks, and the chatter was so incessant that it drowned out Mission Control, just when Ed Gibson was trying to read up crucial data on the burn. "If you're going to talk to me, you're going to have to cut out the relay," Gordon told Houston. "It's impossible with those guys yakking." Gibson finally had to tell Conrad and Bean to be quiet for a few minutes. For safety's sake, Gordon read his checklist over the air as he performed it, so that the flight controllers could check his work.
Finally, the engine lit, and he was slammed into his couch for 14 long seconds. When it was over, a relieved Gordon began to prepare for sleep. Without his crewmates to help out, everything took longer than usual. It was another 2 hours before he finished dinner and the lengthy cleanup for the night. He thought, now's the time to think up all sorts of fancy prose to tell people what it's like to be the lonesome man up here. In truth, he was so tired he was glad just to go to sleep. 3. In the belly of the snowman. On the ocean of storms. 5 days, 5 hours, 25 minutes mission elapsed time. Wide awake, Alan Bean lay in his spacesuit on a beta-cloth hammock that was strung to the sides of Intrepid's cabin. Immediately above him, lying fore aft, Pete Conrad was asleep in his own hammock. Bean looked at his watch. It was 3:45 in the afternoon, Houston time. He and Conrad were halfway into a planned 9-hour sleep period. But sleep did not come easily to Bean. For one thing, his spacesuit was uncomfortable, even without helmet and gloves. He would have preferred to take it off, but that wasn't a good idea, not with all this dust. There was too much risk of clogging a zipper or a wrist ring, but the suit wasn't all that kept Bean awake. Bean had always felt that he thought more about the risks of the job than other astronauts. Still, Bean knew, you can never be sure what goes on in another man's mind, and it wasn't the kind of thing anybody ever talked about. It wasn't that he was anxious about anything in particular. It was more a heightened awareness of his surroundings. Bean heard the whine of Intrepid's cooling pumps. A few hours ago, he and Conrad had just fallen asleep when one of the pumps changed pitch, and both of them awoke with a start, then went back to sleep. He looked up at Conrad's hammock. Even in a spacesuit, Conrad's body barely weighed enough to sag the cloth. It lay almost flat in the lunar gravity. Before the flight, Conrad had told him, "Don't worry. If anything goes wrong, it'll be something you've never seen before." The lightning strike proved him right, but that had not been a harrowing experience for Bean, although, he thought wryly, it would have been if he'd understood what was really happening. Pete had understood, and he'd been cool enough for all three of them. Of course, when it came to the landing on the moon, Conrad had done his share of worrying. That was only natural. And when he did, Bean was able to be reassuring because he knew that if anybody could pull it off, Conrad could. Bean didn't worry much about the piloting end of Apollo 12. In his mind, a mechanical problem was the thing to watch out for. All through the mission, even with the exhilaration of the ride and the wonder of such incredible sights, Bean heard the background noise of his own awareness, reminding him that one of the rules of this game is that all machines eventually fail. For Bean, being on the moon was laced with that awareness. Bean thought about the TV camera. He wondered why it didn't work. He had no way of knowing that the full-strength lunar sunlight had burned the light-sensitive coating right off the Viticon, that it was beyond hope. The camera should have been ready in time for them to train with it at the Cape, but all they'd had was a block of wood. All he knew was that somehow he had managed to screw it up, but there was nothing he could do about it now. Bean thought about the surveyor. Over dinner, he and Conrad had talked about how the shadowed crater wall looked so steep they might not be able to walk along it safely. They would have to wait and see. For now, Bean knew he had to get some rest, or his performance would suffer. If you're not doing something productive, Bean told himself, you should be sleeping. Finally, he drifted into a light slumber. Meanwhile, in the top bunk, Pete Conrad soon awoke, not because his mind was too active, but because he was in pain. The right leg of his spacesuit had been misadjusted before the flight and was slightly too short. Now, as he lay in his hammock, his suit bore down on his shoulder like a vise. He called down to Bean and told him they would have to do something about it before the moonwalk. They got up, took down the hammocks, and then, while Conrad sat on the ascent engine cover, Bean set to work. The leg of the suit was adjusted by a set of cords laced around the calf, like sutures. Bean had to undo each cord, which was tightly knotted, because nobody wanted it to come undone, let it out a little, and retie it. The whole process took about an hour. Then Conrad called Houston, 2 hours ahead of schedule,
and the two men began the new day. Wednesday, November 19th, 10:10 p.m. Houston time, 5 days, 11 hours, 38 minutes mission elapsed time. Morning lasts a week on the moon. For 7 days, the sun slowly climbs in the black lunar sky, shrinking the shadows of rocks and craters. By lunar noon, temperatures climb to 225 degrees Fahrenheit. It takes another week for the sun to descend and then vanish below the western horizon. During the frigid 2-week lunar night, temperatures plummet to 243 degrees below zero. Then the cycle begins anew. When Conrad and Bean ended their first moonwalk, it was about 6:30 a.m. local moon time. Nearly 13 hours later, they stepped outside for the second moonwalk. But in lunar time, only half an hour had elapsed. The sun had climbed only a few degrees, and yet everything looked slightly different. It almost seemed to Bean that a new landscape had taken shape while they slept. He kept noticing rocks that he thought he'd missed the day before. Soon he realized they were the same rocks under different lighting. The colors of the surface, the spectrum of grays and tans and browns that changed as he looked in different directions, seemed a little more vivid. But the real change was in the Surveyor crater. No longer did its walls seem steep and forbidding. It had been transformed into a gentle bowl. Getting to the probe looked to be easy. Along the way, Conrad and Bean would test their skills as lunar field geologists. For years, and especially in the last few months, they'd been schooled in such esoterica as mineral identification, the characteristics of impact craters, the proper techniques for collecting samples. They had honed their skills on the lava flows in Hawaii and the desert of West Texas. When they left the Earth, they did so not only as pilots, but as surrogates for the geologists who would have given their right arms to be in their place. To save precious minutes on the surface, the geologists had sat down ahead of time and planned 4 possible traverses for Conrad and Bean to follow. About 2 weeks before the flight, Conrad decided he wanted to carry maps, and the geologists had quickly drawn them up on a set of photographs. There wasn't time to get them on the official manifest, so Conrad arranged to have them stowed with his personal items. But that wasn't the only unofficial item Conrad had wanted to bring. A longtime collector of hats, he'd arranged for the crew systems people to make a giant blue-and-white baseball cap that would fit over the top of his space helmet. He was going to put it on and wait for everybody on Earth to notice as he bounded past the TV camera. Unfortunately, nobody could figure out a way to get it into the LM in secret. Never mind, Conrad had managed to smuggle something else in the pocket of his spacesuit, and when the time came, he and Bean would have their own little caper on the lunar surface. It turned out that Intrepid lay right on Traverse number 4, which followed a sort of misshapen circle around several craters. The geologists had explained before the mission that the moon's craters are like natural drill holes, that the ferocious energy of meteorite impacts had blasted chunks of rock from the crust and scattered them across the moon. Each crater of the snowman was nothing less than a ready-made excavation into lunar history. By visiting different craters, the geologists hoped the moonwalkers would find out whether the lava flows that formed this region of the Ocean of Storms varied in age and composition. On Earth, a geologist would have spent many days or even weeks on this kind of exploration, but the timeline gave Conrad and Bean a bit less than 2.5 hours to get around the circle. Mindful of all they would try to accomplish, Conrad and Bean assembled a small assortment of gear: rock hammers, sample bags, core tubes, shovel, tongs, and maps, loaded them onto a portable tool carrier, and set off on a journey across the craters. The first stop was the north rim of 360-foot Head Crater, about 100 yards west of the LM. It didn't take long for the men to make a discovery. Bean looked at the places where Conrad's boots had dug into the gray soil and saw that they had uncovered a lighter gray just underneath the surface. They could not hear the excited shouts of the geologists in the back room down the hall from Mission Control, but they knew they had found something significant. Before the mission, the geologists had told Conrad and Bean to look for evidence of a light-colored streak
that was visible on the unmanned orbiter pictures, material that had probably been ejected from the impact that formed huge Copernicus crater 230 miles to the north. Now it appeared they had found some. After the mission, this sample would let the geologists determine the age of the impact that had formed Copernicus, an important event in lunar history. Conrad knew that he and Bean could easily have spent an hour at any one of these craters, but the geologists wanted as many different types of rocks as possible, and the clock was ticking, so he and Bean took off running, heading south to Bench Crater. Yesterday, during the first moonwalk, Bean had found that running on the moon was an experience all its own. He watched as Conrad skipped like a little boy and laughed with delight. "Whee! Up one crater and over another! Does that look as good as it feels?" Bean had discovered a better way. "Pete, bend and rock from side to side as you run. Like that. There you go." It wasn't really a run. It was more of a lope. Push off with one foot, shift your weight, and land on the other. Each step launched him into the air for long seconds, while he wondered whether he would land on a rock or in a pothole. To avoid this, he tried sticking his foot out to one side, but when he landed and pushed off again, his uneven stance set him slowly rotating, giving him a new problem to deal with. He soon learned to anticipate each new step while he was still airborne, shifting his weight as he landed and immediately pushing off, setting up a rhythm, as if he were bounding across a rocky stream. It felt strange, and it was demanding. He couldn't take his eyes off the ground very often, but that only made it more fun, and the moon afforded him a luxury unknown to any runner on Earth, a chance to relax in the midst of each step. It seemed, to Bean's amazement, that he would never get tired. 10:59 p.m. "By the way," Conrad radioed Houston, "this is the smartest idea we've come up with. This map just works great out here." It worked great for Conrad, but most of the time Bean didn't have the foggiest idea where he was. From the surface, really big craters like Head and Bench looked nothing like the big circular bowls on the map. Bean tried to navigate a few times on his own and gave up. It was beyond him how Conrad, running ahead of him, managed to study the map even as he bounded along. While Conrad led the way, Bean scanned the ground for something interesting. It wasn't easy to do field geology at a full gallop, and on the moon it wasn't much easier standing still. Everything was so dust-covered that only the most subtle variations in texture were visible. Even the rocks looked almost exactly alike, until he held one right up to his faceplate. Then he could see hints of what lay beneath the dusty coating, the green glint of olivine crystals or a chunky white grain of feldspar. He could even see tiny pits, actually craters made by micrometeorites, peppering the sides of the rock, and he was telling Houston all about it when, "Hey, Al, quit baloneying and give me a hand." Conrad cut him off. Bean understood. The geologists were going to have the rest of their lives to study these rocks. Why waste time talking about them? And in the back of his mind, Conrad was thinking, gotta get around the circle. The spindly white probe, in Conrad's mind, the mission's finish line, was waiting for them. Fortunately, Ed Gibson had good news. The moonwalk was being extended by half an hour. 11:31 p.m. "You know what I feel like, Al?"
"What?"
"Did you ever see those pictures of giraffes running in slow motion?" Bean laughed. He knew what Conrad was talking about. He watched Conrad's feet as he ran along beside him. Each time his boots hit the surface, they sprayed a small shower of dust, sailing out on perfect trajectories. As they ran by the southern rim of Bench Crater, they were beginning to feel the strain of their adventure. The entire run to the Surveyor Crater was slightly uphill, and they could feel it. Their mouths were as dry as the desert from breathing pure oxygen. "Tell you one thing I'd go for," Conrad said, "is a good drink of ice water." To make matters more difficult for Bean, the tool carrier was getting heavy with rocks. He had to hold it up to his chest while he ran to keep the rocks from bouncing out. This meant he was constantly fighting the arms of the suit. Before the mission, he'd been so conscientious about exercise. Every day he'd run a couple of miles on the hard beach at the Cape, pounding his legs into shape, and it turned out that most of the work was in the arms and especially the hands. He told Ed Gibson to pass on a message to Fred Hayes, the lunar module pilot for Apollo 13, to do hand exercises. Meanwhile, in Houston, the flight surgeon saw Conrad's and Bean's heart rates soar to 160 beats per minute. Ed Gibson passed on a message from the surgeon to the lunar surface in code. "Pete and Al, we'd like an EMU check." EMU stood for Extravehicular Mobility Unit, in other words, the spacesuit and backpack. Ostensibly, this was a request for each man to read out his oxygen supply and report any anomalies in suit pressure or the like, but in reality, it let Gibson tell the men to cool it for a couple of minutes without letting the whole world know about it. Conrad and Bean got the message, and they read out their oxygen quantity and the rest of it, but they couldn't bring themselves to stand around and do nothing. An interesting rock caught their eye, and they set about collecting it. Then they were on the run again. Everyone in Mission Control could hear them huffing and puffing. The two men ran onward in their long, gliding, slow-motion giraffe strides under the black dome of the lunar sky. Bean looked up as he ran, above the solar glare, and found a glittering crescent set in the velvet, exactly where it had been the day before. He looked down at his feet again, watching out for potholes and rocks, then leaned his head back for another glance. For just a moment, he silenced the voice in his head that always called him back to work, to the rule of the clock, and he talked to himself. This is the moon. That is the earth. I'm really here. Suddenly, Bean felt his ears pop. His suit must be losing pressure. Heart pounding, he stopped and checked the gauge on his wrist. No change. It must have been some kind of weird transient. Only after the flight would the engineers decide that, as Bean ran in the light gravity, his body had bounced against the oxygen outflow port within his suit, closing it momentarily and causing a slight increase in suit pressure. But just now that taste of fear was enough to put Bean's thoughts right back on the traverse. After that, he stopped looking up for a while. Thursday, November 20th, 12:15 a.m., Houston time. Standing on the rim of the surveyor crater, Conrad and Bean rested for a moment. Just beyond the far wall, they could see Intrepid, like a tiny replica. To their right, 300 feet away, sat Surveyor 3, gleaming in the morning sunlight. Antennas and sensors still reached upward from its tubular frame, just as they had on April 20, 1967, when the craft thumped onto the moon amid blasts from its braking rockets. Like Intrepid, it had the strange organic look of a craft designed for the void of space. Fuel tanks and batteries protruded from its open frame. This unlikely robot had made history when its mechanical claw, under command from Earth, had scraped the skin of the moon and given scientists their first real information on the physical nature of the lunar soil. It had lasted just 15 days until the onset of lunar darkness. It was a relic now, but it was about to make one more contribution to space exploration. There was some concern, both on the moon and in Mission Control, that Surveyor 3 might welcome its first visitors by sliding down the crater wall on top of them. For that reason, Conrad and Bean had decided to approach from the side, following the contour of the sloping wall. This was a relatively old crater, and the geologists had warned them to expect a soft, thick dust blanket here, but the men were relieved to find firm ground that gave good footing. With slow, careful steps, they closed in. They could see, to their surprise, that the surveyor wasn't white anymore, but a light tan. Had it been baked by the sun, or had Conrad and Bean sprayed it with dust when they landed? They'd investigate when they got closer, and they'd take pictures of it from every angle, and more pictures of the soil and rocks nearby, so the scientists could compare them with the surveyor's own images from 31 months earlier. They'd collect some of those rocks, and then Conrad would snip off pieces of the craft to take home. But before they poked, prodded, and otherwise cannibalized the probe, there was something Al Bean and Pete Conrad wanted to do. Before the mission, they'd had one of the support crew go out and buy an automatic timer for the Hasselblad, a little spring-loaded gadget. Conrad and Bean's idea was that they would mount the camera on the tool carrier and then pose, side by side, next to the surveyor. It would only take a minute for them to fire off a few shots, saluting, waving, shaking hands, whatever, and Conrad was sure that when they got home, one of those pictures would end up on the cover of Life magazine. He couldn't wait until everybody asked, "Who took the picture?" Conrad had managed to smuggle the timer in the pocket of his spacesuit. He had remembered to bring it into the LM with him, and just before they'd headed out on the Traverse that morning, he'd dropped it into the tool carrier, which was now full of rocks and tenacious lunar dust. Bean rummaged in the bag for a moment, looking for a glint of chrome, but saw only grime. The only solution was to take all of the rocks out of the tool carrier. They couldn't talk about it. The whole world would know what they were up to. So they made hand signals. While Conrad held the tool carrier, Bean rummaged among the samples, each in their little Teflon baggies. He wondered if he should just put the tool carrier down, get on his knees, and lay the rocks on the ground, but he worried he'd never get them all back in the bag if he did. After a couple of minutes, Bean realized the timer was buried inside the bag, lost in the dust. He said quietly, "Forget it." 12:38 a.m. "Okay, Houston," said Conrad. "I'm jiggling it. The surveyor is firmly planted here. That's no problem." Having assured mission control, Conrad wielded a pair of cutting shears. The engineers wanted some samples of metal tubing to see how it had been affected by 31 months on the surface. But what Conrad wanted most of all was the surveyor's TV camera. With all its circuitry and moving parts, it was the real prize. Conrad wrestled with the shears as he tried to cut through the camera's support struts. "Okay, two more tubes on that TV camera, and that baby's ours." Another cut. "There's one," Conrad said. Now Bean gripped the camera with his gloves, and at last, "It's ours," Conrad cackled. That TV camera was his trophy fish. 1:19 a.m. Back at Intrepid, Conrad was emptying the tool carrier into the rock box when suddenly out fell the Hasselblad timer. He called to Bean. "I've got something for you." "Just what we need," Bean said. He picked up the timer and threw it into the distance as hard as he could. 6:55 a.m. 5 days, 19 hours, 33 minutes mission elapsed time. Pete Conrad was exhausted. He sat on the floor of Intrepid's tiny cabin, leaning against the wall in his grimy spacesuit. As tired as he was, he couldn't believe he and Bean had climbed into the LM after only 4 hours outside, with all that extra oxygen, maybe a couple of hours' worth, still in their backpacks. He wasn't about to tell Houston how frustrated he was. Before the flight, he'd agreed that if Mission Control gave him one-time extension during each moonwalk, he wouldn't ask for a second one. So he and Bean had some time to kill. They ate lunch, and then they started into the checklist for liftoff. They were about an hour ahead of schedule, and when they came to the T-minus 30 minutes mark in the count, they stopped, because the next steps, pressurizing the fuel tanks, for example, would have to wait until the proper time. For now, Conrad rested. Conrad looked at Bean. He seemed nervous. There was absolutely nothing to do but watch the clock, but Bean was fidgeting with something on one of the instrument panels. What was he thinking? Conrad remembered how he had felt on his own first space flight, Gemini 5, crammed into that tiny spacecraft with Gordo Cooper after a week in orbit, circling the Earth over and over. Conrad found himself thinking about the retro rockets, which had been soaking in the frigid cold of space for days on end, longer than anybody had ever been in space before. Conrad was terrified that when it came time to fire the retros, nothing would happen, in which case he was sure he would slit his wrists. When the retros fired right on schedule, he breathed a huge sigh of relief. Now, on the moon, he was sure Bean was going through the same drill about the ascent engine. For his own part, Conrad had no such worries this time around. He'd already been through three launches in his career. This was just another one in a different place. In any case, if Conrad had any lingering doubts, he put them aside when he saw his lunar module pilot. Finally, Conrad said, "Bino, are you worried about the engine?" Bean answered a quiet, "Yep." And Conrad tried a bit of humor. "Well, there's no sense worrying about it, Al, because if it don't work, we're just going to become the first permanent monument to the space program." Conrad wasn't sure the joke made any difference in Bean's outlook, but an hour later, when the moment of truth arrived, there were no unpleasant surprises, and then
as the ocean of storms fell away in one last spectacular view, Pete Conrad and Al Bean headed for a reunion with a best friend in lunar orbit. Friday, November 21st, aboard Yankee Clipper in lunar orbit. Bean was looking out the window. It was the first chance he'd had to relax and play tourist since arriving at the moon more than 2 days earlier. He thought about how strange it felt to orbit the moon. The strangest thing about it was the silence. There wasn't any engine noise, the way there always was in an airplane, and it felt odd to see the spacecraft fly in the same direction no matter how it was pointed. Orbiting the moon, Bean thought, was much more of a science fiction experience than walking on it had been. Flying in space was better than Bean had ever imagined during those long years as a rookie. Yesterday, during the rendezvous, he'd been slaving away with the backup computer and the navigation charts while Conrad flew the lunar module. They had one more burn to do, and then they would have it made. And Conrad had said to him, "Why don't you just quit after this mid-course and relax and enjoy it? You can take a minute and fly this vehicle." Startled by Pete's audacity, Bean wondered, wouldn't it put them off course? "No," Conrad assured him. Whatever digressions they made would be easy to correct. Bean was reluctant. Surely Mission Control would know. Conrad laughed. "Not on the backside of the moon, they won't." Bean realized Conrad had planned this perfectly, and for a few minutes, Bean had his hand at the crisp, responsive ascent stage. It was a moment that Bean would always remember as pure Pete Conrad, that in a small craft somewhere over the far side of the moon, he had taken the time to share with Bean a flying experience that even most astronauts would never know. And then Bean could see Yankee Clipper out ahead, growing slowly from a point of light into a gleaming spacecraft. He watched as the command module moved from sunlight into shadow and back again, thinking, "That looks so neat." Dick Gordon did a perfect job on the docking, smooth as glass, and later, when he opened the tunnel to the LM, all he could see was two dim figures floating in a cloud of dust. He called down, "You guys ain't gonna mess up my nice clean spacecraft." Before he would even let them into the command module, he made them take off their filthy suits. They passed them up through the tunnel, and Gordon hurriedly zipped them into their stowage bags underneath the couches. Finally, when he and Conrad got up there, Gordon was happier than Bean had ever seen him. He was scurrying around, helping them stow their gear. He was offering them a drink of water. And in that moment, Bean was filled with a love for his crewmates that he had never experienced. Years later, Bean would say, his most special memories of the flight would not be about the moon or the Earth. They would be about Pete Conrad and Dick Gordon. Now Bean looked out at the bright, bleak cinder passing beyond his window. It was so utterly inhospitable. Everything in the universe has some function, Bean thought. But what is the function of the moon? Is it to make the tides? The Earth would probably get along fine without them. Maybe it was as the geologist said. The moon is here to tell us the story that had been lost forever on our own planet. Maybe the moon would tell us where we came from. Bean didn't know the answer. As Yankee Clipper circled, Bean looked, and now and then he wondered. He found himself thinking about the 6-year journey that had gotten him here. He realized now, with his neck farther out than it had ever been, that life is too precious to spend it living by someone else's rules, even the unwritten ones of the astronaut office. He would be a good astronaut, but he would do it his way. As the moon bore silent witness, he told himself, "When I get back home, if I get back home, I'm going to live my life the way I want to." On the way back to Earth, Pete Conrad wasn't feeling well. For one thing, he had somehow managed to come down with a cold. "How did I get the world's greatest cold on the moon, for Christ's sakes?" Bean answered, "Because you had the world's greatest LMP with you on the moon, who had a cold." Where Bean's cold had come from, he had no idea. Then there was the rash on Conrad's chest. He'd had a reaction to something in the adhesive that stuck the biomedical sensors to his skin, and it raised itchy welts, like a bad case of poison ivy.
It was almost the best moment of the flight when Houston finally told him he could take them off. Bean was out of it, too. Or at least it seemed that way to Conrad and Gordon. He was spending much of his time on the way back to Earth sacked out in his sleeping bag. Not surprising, he'd peaked for the landing and the moonwalks, and the trip home was definitely an anticlimax. A couple of days ago, Conrad would have been happy to fire up that SPS engine longer than the flight plan called for and come barreling out of lunar orbit so fast that they would trim a day off the return, but Houston wasn't about to let them do that. There was plenty of time to think on the way back, and Conrad did. He was proud of Apollo 12. They'd proven the pinpoint landing capability and accomplished their other objectives. Now astronauts could go to the places the scientists wanted them to. But along with the immense feelings of elation and satisfaction, there was something else, something Conrad hadn't expected. After 7 years of eating, sleeping, breathing Apollo, he had finally had his mission, and it had been perfect, and now, just like that, it was all over. The flying had been brief but challenging. The sights had been the most spectacular of his life, and yet going to the moon wasn't what Conrad had expected. Yes, it was spectacular, but it wasn't momentous. Looking back on it now, he couldn't shake the feeling that it had been so much like the training that it was almost an anticlimax. Take away the weightlessness and the view, and he might as well have been in the simulator. 7 years ago, he had told himself that if he made it to the moon, he wouldn't let it change him. Now he had no worries that it would. Conrad kept these thoughts to himself as Yankee Clipper headed home, and he had no idea whether his crewmates felt the same way. He was quite surprised when Al Bean turned to him and said, as if he could read his mind, "It's kind of like the song. Is that all there is?" Sometime after he and Dick Gordon and Al Bean got out of quarantine, Pete Conrad got his crew together for a survival meeting of sorts. It was time to talk about their futures. For his own part, Conrad had not known how he might feel about the moon after the flight, but now that he was home, he already knew he wanted to go back. It was a spectacular place, and he had proved to himself that it was also a fine workplace. Before the flight, he'd always daydreamed that he and Gordon and Bean would each return to the moon as commanders of their own missions. Gordon would land on Apollo 18, Bean on 19, and himself on 20. There had been talk about bringing along a one-man lunar flyer for those last two missions to expand the range of an astronaut in search of discoveries. In his daydreams, he and Bean would develop the flyer and then test it out on their missions. But the flyer had been canceled in favor of a four-wheeled lunar roving vehicle, and it was clear now that budget cuts would force NASA to cancel the final lunar landing, Apollo 20, to free up a Saturn V for its Earth Orbit Space Station project. Apollo 18 and 19 didn't look much more secure. For all their jokes about staying together as a crew forever, Conrad, Gordon, and Bean knew they would have to break up. Conrad planned to get out of Apollo and onto the space station project because that's where the available seats were. He told his crew they should do the same, and Bean planned to take his advice. But Dick Gordon decided to stay on. Going by the pattern of Deke Slayton's crew rotation, he would probably be assigned as the backup commander for Apollo 15 and then command Apollo 18. Conrad reminded him that Apollo 18 could disappear, but Gordon said he would take his chances. Having come so close to his goal, he couldn't give up now. Chapter 7. The Crown of an Astronaut's Career. Apollo 13. 1. A Change of Fortune. The new decade opened with a nation polarized by the war in Vietnam and a space agency unsure of its future. After a year of triumph, NASA faced a combination of public apathy and outright hostility for costly, high-tech government boondoggles like putting men on the moon. At the same time, NASA's leaders were on uncertain footing with the Nixon White House. Already faced with the leanest NASA budget in 9 years, Tom Paine had suspended production of the Saturn V, leaving enough boosters to fly missions through Apollo 20. But Apollo applications, the project to launch a temporary space station made from Apollo spare parts, was already going ahead,
and now it became clear that a Saturn V would be needed to launch the station into Earth orbit. In January 1970, Payne canceled Apollo 20, and before long there were signs that two more Apollo flights were in jeopardy. Meanwhile, preparations went ahead for Apollo 13, set for a spring 1970 launch. But within NASA, the question was raised, was it time to abandon the moon? In recent days, none other than the MSC's director, Bob Gilruth, had privately called for an end to the moon landing program. Some called Gilruth the father of manned spaceflight. No one had done more to make Apollo a reality, and no one had higher regard for the astronauts. To them, too, he had always been something of a father. Even more than most of the safety-conscious NASA managers, Gilruth had sweated every new mission, but he had always been willing to take the risks, provided they were worthwhile. But there were new challenges and new programs on the horizon. With two lunar landings accomplished, was it wise to risk men's lives and NASA's future again and again? Gilruth wasn't at all sure that it was. Stop now, he said, before we lose somebody. NASA was a democratic organization in which such opinions were freely expressed, but Gilruth's entreaties did not change the course of Apollo. Everyone knew how risky a venture it was, and sometimes it seemed as though they were tempting fate with each new mission, and no one realized this more than the astronauts. Any of them, if asked, would have said that it was just a matter of time before some hidden flaw in the system, some unnoticed mistake that the quality control checks hadn't caught would come around to bite them. Spaceflight had always been a game of probability, but Jim Lovell, commander of Apollo 13, had no reason to suspect, as he and his crew headed moonward on an April evening, that the odds would finally turn against them that night. Monday, April 13th, 1970, 8:56 p.m., Houston time. For the first time in weeks, Marilyn Lovell could finally relax. She was sitting in the VIP viewing room that looked out over Mission Control, watching a telecast from her husband's moon-bound spacecraft, and what she saw cheered her. There was Jim, floating in the command module. The image was shadowy, and Jim's face was hard to make out at times, but to Marilyn it could not have been more heartening. Here was a portrait of a man in his element. Everything was going beautifully. Jim and his lunar module pilot, a rookie named Fred Hayes, had just given a televised tour of their lander, Aquarius, and had displayed some of their gear, their space helmets, the hammocks they would sleep on, and special bags for drinking water that they would wear inside their spacesuits while they walked on the moon. Now, back in the command module, Odyssey, Jim was acting as MC. "We might give you a quick shot of our entertainment aboard the spacecraft," he said, holding up a small tape recorder. He brought it close to his communications microphone and turned it on. Light piano combo music filled the airwaves. Jim had no way of knowing that his words were going no further than the NASA centers. After two flawless lunar landing missions, the networks weren't going to cut into the Doris Day show or the other primetime programs to carry yet another telecast from space. Marilyn was here in the control center because it was the only place for her to watch. "It's interesting," Jim said as he turned off the music, "to see that tape recorder floating there playing the theme from 2001 A Space Odyssey. And, of course, our tapes wouldn't be complete without Aquarius." Marilyn was grateful things were going so well, grateful for the chance to feel good again. In the weeks before the flight, she had felt an inexplicable sense of foreboding. Jim had made three flights before this one, including the first trip around the moon, but she had never been this anxious before any of those missions. It wasn't superstition, though she could confess to having had a twinge of that when she learned, the previous August, that Jim would command Apollo number 13. It was more a feeling that he had been lucky too long, and that it was only a matter of time before his luck would run out. Still, she had not raised any objections, because she knew how much this flight meant to him. At last he was going to do the thing he had wanted to do since he'd become an astronaut 8 years before. He was going to land on the moon. Last week, Marilyn had gone to the Cape to see Jim, and she had planned to return to Houston to watch the launch. But when it came time to leave, she found that she could not. So she stayed, to bid him farewell the way she had on Apollo 8. Silently, while his rocket rose on a pillar of flame and disappeared into the sky. But as Jim had confided to her during a moonlit walk along the beach, Apollo 13 would be his last mission. Also in the viewing room this Monday evening was a quiet young astronaut named Ken Mattingly, a member of the 5th astronaut group. He was 34 years old, tall and thin, his brown, crew-cut hair almost gone. Mattingly was perhaps the most private man in the astronaut office. Even the other astronauts would not claim to know him well, but they would not have been surprised to learn that this evening Mattingly was in the depths of the worst depression of his life. Just a week ago, Mattingly had been the command module pilot on Apollo 13. Now he was a spectator. The weekend before launch, Charlie Duke, the backup lunar module pilot, came down with a case of German measles. He'd caught it from the child of a friend. The NASA doctors said Duke wasn't contagious and his illness had been incubating for 2 weeks, during which time he'd been to meetings and meals with Lovell, Mattingly, and Hayes. Any one of them might also come down with German measles in the next 2 weeks. With less than a week until launch and the culmination of 9 months of preparation, Lovell's crew were at the mercy of the doctors, who made daily blood tests and waited for the disease to show itself. By Wednesday, the doctors had decided that Lovell and Hayes were probably immune, but they could not be sure about Mattingly. His blood tests, they said, showed that he might already be fighting off the disease and could develop full-blown symptoms during the mission. By Thursday, Chuck Berry was recommending that Mattingly be pulled off the flight and that his backup, Jack Swigert, be sent in his place. And Mattingly was going through hell. Like most pilots, Mattingly had an aversion to doctors. Pilots had a saying, there are only two ways you can walk out of a doctor's office, fine or grounded. More than one astronaut had sneaked off to a private physician who was sworn to secrecy rather than risk seeing a NASA doctor. And as the week wore on, Mattingly began to feel as though the doctors were not on his side. They were waking him up at 6 a.m. to draw blood. At 5 p.m. they drew more blood. Then they sent him to bed saying, now don't worry. And then the next morning they'd wake him up again and say, it doesn't look like you had a very good night's sleep. The whole process was enough to make anybody doubt his own sanity. Aside from these hassles, Mattingly felt absolutely fine. But by Thursday, Swigert was being put through his paces in the command module simulator, and Deke Slayton was keeping a close eye on his work. Still, it was inconceivable to Mattingly that he would be left behind. He thought the doctors would either fill him up with so much gamma globulin he couldn't conceivably get sick, or else NASA would postpone the flight until the next launch window in May. His friends were consistently upbeat. If they believed his fate was sealed, they couldn't bring themselves to say so. Friday, the day before launch, the decision was due. With Swigert getting all the simulator time, Mattingly had little to do, and he could only go running for so many miles on the Space Center's roadbeds. Slayton suggested he go flying. Mattingly drove to Patrick Air Force Base and did just that for a couple of hours in a T-33. Afterward, he considered breaking the pre-mission medical quarantine to cheer himself up with some Dunkin' Donuts. Those and the barbecue sandwiches at Fat Boys were his main weaknesses at the Cape, but decided against it. He was wearing his blue NASA flight suit. Surely he'd be recognized. Heading back to the Space Center, he turned on the car radio in time to hear a newscast. NASA has announced that it will replace one of the three astronauts of Apollo 13, Thomas K. Mattingly. Suddenly it was real. Mattingly was furious to find out this way, but he wasn't about to blame anyone, especially not Deke. By the time he had reached the crew quarters, he'd accepted the news. Jim and Fred were still over in the simulator, and everyone else reacted to Mattingly's presence with an awkward silence. Mattingly didn't have any more idea of what to say than they did. Slayton asked him what he wanted to do, and he answered that he needed to get away before the launch. Fine, Slayton said. He could grab an airplane and fly home that evening. After dinner, he wished Lovell, Hayes, and Jack Swigert good luck.
When he arrived at Patrick, a T-33 was on the ramp, ready and waiting. Flying through the early spring night, Mattingly was surprised to find the normally laconic air traffic controllers calling him on the radio and chatting up a storm. He realized they were trying to make sure that he was awake. When he landed at Ellington, the ground crew was already waiting to take care of his airplane. He had only to get in his car and go home, and he realized that Deke Slayton must have quietly arranged for all of this. It was just the kind of thing Deke would do, and never acknowledge. Now, watching the television transmission from Apollo 13, Mattingly was still in the depression that had descended on him 4 days ago. A distraction would have helped, but he had nothing whatsoever to do except watch the progress of the mission he should have been on. 8:59 p.m. Jim Lovell ended the telecast with a farewell that had the ring of a 1940s radio announcer. "This is the crew of Apollo 13 wishing everybody there a nice evening." All he needed was a closing theme song, and we're just about ready to close out our inspection of Aquarius and get back for a pleasant evening in Odyssey. Good night. The TV monitors went blank, and Marilyn left, pleased that her husband was having a good mission. Mattingly, meanwhile, remained in the viewing room, listening to the voices of his former crewmates. In a few minutes, he and a friend planned to go out and have a beer. At age 42, Jim Lovell was the most traveled man alive. With 3 space flights under his belt, he had racked up 572 hours and nearly 7 million miles, more than any other astronaut or cosmonaut. For many men, that would have been enough, but not for Jim Lovell. From the day he joined the astronaut corps in 1962, his ultimate goal had been to command a lunar mission. Command was even more important to Jim Lovell than landing on the moon, and most veteran astronauts felt the same way. When Borman turned down Deke Slayton's tentative offer to fly the first lunar landing, it had everything to do with the fact that he had been the commander on Apollo 8. If Lovell had any disappointment about his commander's decision, it vanished when Slayton assigned him to lead Neil Armstrong's backup crew. Within weeks after Armstrong's team came back from the moon, Lovell and his crew were training for their own landing. By the spring of 1970, most of Lovell's colleagues from the second astronaut group had moved on to other things. Neil Armstrong had disappeared into the world of post-flight PR that greeted him on his return from Apollo 11. It seemed unlikely he would fly again. Jim McDivitt had traded the demands of flying Apollo missions for the equally demanding job of preparing for them as manager of the Apollo Spacecraft Program Office in Houston. Tom Stafford, though still on flight status, had replaced Al Shepard as chief of the astronaut office and wasn't scheduled for another mission, and Frank Borman had begun a new life as a vice president with Eastern Airlines. One day Borman came by for a visit while Lovell was in the simulator, and he seemed glad to be free of the training grind. "Jim," he said, "aren't you tired of this? I wouldn't want to go through this again." Lovell couldn't have felt more differently. This was his 7th time around, counting the stints on backup crews, and even now his appetite for spaceflight was undiminished. He himself described it as an addiction. He could have gone on until NASA said he was too old to fly anymore, but he knew that when he came back from Apollo 13, he would face a long wait, perhaps several years before he flew again. Well aware of the astronauts still waiting for their first flights, he decided he would not get back online for a 5th. Apollo 13 would be a great finale to a long spaceflight career. Like every commander, Lovell wanted his mission to stand out, but he couldn't see why people would remember the 3rd lunar landing, and that was fine with him. He wanted badly to land on the moon, and he was glad for the chance to make a contribution to science. The Apollo 13 mission patch read, "Ex Luna Scientia, from the moon, knowledge," and Lovell thought of that when he christened his lunar module Aquarius, after the god of the ancient Egyptians who brought life to the Nile Valley, not to mention the popular song from the Broadway musical Hair. The command module Odyssey, meanwhile, took its name not only from Homer's epic work, but from Arthur C. Clarke's science fiction vision of space travel. When Lovell was back on Earth, he would find irony in Odyssey's dictionary definition, a long voyage with many changes of fortune. 9:08 p.m. Houston time, 2 days, 7 hours, 54 minutes mission elapsed time aboard Apollo 13.
The TV show was over, and Lovell waited in the lower equipment bay for Hayes to finish closing up Aquarius for the night. They were about to shoot some pictures of Comet Bennett, an icy celestial wanderer that had graced the spring skies. But first, Mission Control wanted Jack Swigert to stir up the service module's tanks of cryogenic liquid hydrogen and oxygen. In zero-G, the supercold fluids tended to become stratified, making it difficult for the astronauts and controllers in Houston to get accurate quantity readings. To remedy the problem, each tank contained a fan that acted like an egg beater to stir the contents. Strapped into the left-hand couch, Swigert flipped the switches marked H2 fans and O2 fans and waited several seconds, then turned the fans off. A moment later, there was a loud, dull bang. At first, Lovell thought he knew what it was. The LM's cabin repressurization valve made a bang whenever it was activated, and Hayes had enjoyed scaring his crewmates half to death with it. Looking into the tunnel, Lovell called out, "Fred, do you know what that noise was?" Hayes's dark eyes registered surprise. He hadn't touched the noisy pressure valve. Suddenly, the master alarm rang in their headsets. In Odyssey's left seat, Jack Swigert looked up at the caution and warning panel and was alarmed to see that the light labeled Main Bus B Undervolt glowed red. Main Bus B was one of the command module's electrical junctions, and the warning light could only mean that something had disrupted the flow of power to the command module systems, perhaps an electrical short. If so, it was very bad news. Swigert called to Lovell, "The main B light is on." The electrical system was Fred Hayes's specialty, and now Swigert called out to him to come back to the command module. In the meantime, he floated over to Hayes's side and scanned the electrical gauges. To his surprise, the voltage and current readings looked normal, and so did the fuel cells. Maybe there had been some kind of momentary glitch. But the bang, he'd felt it. The whole spacecraft had shuddered. It had scared the hell out of him. With only slight urgency in his voice, he called Mission Control. "Okay, Houston, we've had a problem." "This is Houston," said Jack Losma. "Say again, please." Lovell was back in the center couch now. He keyed his mic. "Houston, we've had a problem. We've had a main B bus undervolt." "Roger, main B undervolt." There was a pause. "Okay, stand by 13, we're looking at it." Swigert could see no clear explanation on Odyssey's instrument panel. Something must have happened to the lunar module. He wondered if a meteorite had struck it. The chances were supposed to be infinitesimal, but it would only take one sand-sized particle moving at 8 or 9 miles per second to cause crippling damage. If Aquarius had been hit, it could be losing pressure this very second. Swigert glanced toward the open hatchway and had the same thought that comes to men in a submarine taking on water, seal off the damage. As soon as Hayes reappeared, Lovell and Swigert tried to install the forward hatch at the mouth of the tunnel, but it would not close. In their haste, they had misaligned it. Suddenly, they realized there was no air leak. Apparently, nothing was wrong with Aquarius at all. But as Fred Hayes was now discovering, something was very wrong with Odyssey. When he heard the bang, and then Swigert's call, Hayes had dropped what he was doing in the LM and headed for the command module. As he floated through the tunnel, he heard pinging and popping noises, the sound of metal flexing. The walls of the tunnel were bending as the two joined spacecraft rocked back and forth against each other. Something had jolted Apollo 13. He heard the sound of Odyssey's thrusters firing in response. Quickly, Hayes made his way to his seat on the right side of the command module and began to investigate. Odyssey's electric power came from 3 chemical power plants called fuel cells, housed in the service module. Each fuel cell mixed hydrogen and oxygen to produce water. The byproduct of this reaction was